from deep inside your radio.
See, the problem with Europe, the problem with European countries is even if they were once great or may still harbor somewhat amusing fantasies of greatness, okay, they think they were or they are great, but they don't think they're good. See, we're great. We, the United States, and we're good. We're a good country. That's Europe doesn't have that. So when you look at a guy like a Saddam Hussein and you think, this is bad. This is a bad man. Because who else could possibly conceive of something as evil as spreading smallpox to a civilian population? I mean, there was the thing with the army and the blankets and the Indians. All right, who else could conceive of inflicting nuclear weaponry on a civilian population? Well, it shortened the war. We had to. Who? All right, he poison gassed his own ethnic, a troublesome ethnic minority. He gassed them, ladies and gentlemen. When everybody knows that if you're a good and civilized nation, you don't do that to an ethnic minority. You may enslave them, but you don't gas them. All right, so today we will bask in our own goodness. Hello, welcome to the show.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it starts to rain. Rained real hard to rain for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rolls all day, the river rolls all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River have busted through, clear down to Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana. That time to wash us away. That time to wash us away. Louisiana. Louisiana. That time to wash us away. That time to wash us away. President Cooley's come down to the railroad. That man with a notepad in his hand. President say, little fat man, admit a shame. What the river has done to this poor cracker's land. Louisiana. Louisiana. They're trying to wash us.
Hey, It was on one bright March morning I bid New Orleans adieu, and I took the road to Jackson Town, my fortune to renew. I coursed all foreign money, no credit could I gain, which filled my heart with longing for the lakes of Pontchartrain. When I stepped on board of a railroad car beneath the morning sun, I rode the Ross till evening, and it laid me down again. All strangers there, no friends to me, till a dark girl towards me came, and I fell in love with a Creole girl by the lakes of Pontchartrain. I said, me pretty Creole girl, me money here's no good, and if it weren't for the alligators, I'd sleep out in the wood. You're welcome here, kind stranger. Our house is very plain, but we never turned a stranger out on the bank upon your train. She took me into her mammy's house, and she treated me right well. There upon her shoulders in jet black ringlets fell, to try to paint her beauty, I'm sure would be in vain. So handsome was my Creole girl by the lakes of Pontchartrain. Well, I asked her if she'd marry me. She said this could never be, for she had got a lover, and he was far at sea. She said that she would wait for him, true she would remain, till he returned to his Creole girl by the lake of Pontchartrain. So fare thee well, me bonny young girl, I never may see you more, but I'll ne'er forget your kindness in the cottage by the shore, and at each social gathering, a flowing glass I'll drain, and I'll drink a health to me Creole girl by the lakes of Pontchartrain.
No more to roam. Home is where the heart is. The funny part is my husband right there all along. No more tears and no more sighs and no more fears. I'll say no more goodbyes. A triple beckons me. I swear I'm gonna refuse. I'm gonna settle down and there'll be no more blues. Traveled round the world in search of happiness, but all the happiness I found was in my hometown. No more blues, I'm going back home. No, no more dues, I'm through with all my wandering. Now I'll settle down and never roam and find a man and build a home. When we settle down, there'll be no more blues, nothing but happiness. When we settle down, there'll be no more blues.
From the edge of America, from the home of the, still the home of the homeless, the city council in Santa Monica this week passed up an opportunity, well, delayed consideration of ordinances that would crack down on sleeping in doorways. Still the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to the show. So all you home of the homeless wannabes, take one step back. The yellow line has moved. Ladies and gentlemen, burying the lead. We've talked about this. This is where what you would think would be the salient element of the news story is way, way down near the bottom of the story. From Washington, Reuters. This isn't the Reuters burying the lead. The FBI knew before the September 11th attacks last year that several associates of Osama bin Laden had trained at U.S. flight schools, But the FBI believed the Al-Qaeda leader needed pilots to transport goods in Afghanistan. You know, because of the roads and the thing. That's according to a congressional investigator this week. The commonly held view at the FBI prior to 9/11 was that bin Laden needed pilots to operate aircraft he had purchased in the United States to move men and material, according to Eleanor Hill, staff director of that joint congressional committee. The reference to bin Laden buying aircraft in the United States, buried in the middle of her testimony, was left unexplained. Congressional officials said they could not go beyond the unclassified report. He's buying planes in the United States. Let's bury that. Buried in the dossier that Tony Blair's government in Britain issued this week to buttress its support for the United States. You heard about that, that big 55-page dossier. Still, how many of us read it? You know? So it was big. It's too big for that. Not too big to lift, but too big to read. Anyway, buried deep within that, Iraq has been involved in chemical and biological warfare research for over 30 years. Its chemical warfare research started in 1971. Isn't that like 6 or 7 years before Saddam Hussein ever dreamed of taking power? Yes, I think it is. Iraq started biological warfare research in the mid-1970s. Iraq's nuclear program was established in the 1950s. Is that burying the lead or what, ladies and gentlemen? They've been doing this since Britain drew the lines on the map and said, hey, you're Iraq. The quote of the week, however, comes from Miami, Florida. O.J. Simpson is denying allegations that he sped through a manatee zone in a powerboat. He's accused of driving a 30-foot powerboat on the 4th of July. Whee! And was ticketed for creating a wake in a manatee zone. He has pleaded innocent to the speeding charge. Simpson's attorney says the ex-football star's former girlfriend, Christy Prody, and another couple were on board the boat. But the police officer who wrote the ticket says he only saw Simpson and Prody aboard. Simpson's attorney still is complaining about the media attention Simpson gets since he was acquitted of murdering his ex-wife in the criminal trial and found liable for it in the civil trial, and her friend Ron Goldman as well. Attorney Yale Galanter, this is his Florida attorney, says of O.J. Simpson, quote, this guy can't get a break, unquote. We're just going to let that sit there, aren't we? It's just going to sit there and simmer and soak in its own broth. That's a quote that makes its own gravy, ladies and gentlemen, really does. This guy can't get a break. He's boating on the 4th of July in a manatee zone. All right, so apropos of, again, following up, and we now have nailed it down to Condoleezza Rice said it, but she's not the only one who said, we couldn't have imagined anybody thinking about taking an airplane and using it as a weapon and driving it into a building. And I've been adducing suggestions to the contrary, that indeed it had been imagined. In this from Steve in Thomasville, Georgia, an emailer to this broadcast. In April or May of 2001, a pilot crashed a small plane into a broadcast tower at Trois-Rivières, Quebec. The plane was wedged into the tower and it could not be extracted along with the pilot's body. The tower was blown up as the only safe solution. This was reported in one of the broadcast industry news magazines. And from David in Los Angeles, I happened on the following reference while glancing at a copy of the liner notes to Stephen Sondheim's musical play, Assassins. Quote, Samuel Bike, 1930-1974, unemployed tire salesman, attempted to assassinate President Richard Nixon, February 22, 1974, by hijacking a commercial jetliner that he intended to crash dive into the White House. Killed two before he himself was killed, unquote. 1974, ladies and gentlemen. The Intelligence Committee this week heard an offhand comment by a Minneapolis FBI supervisor who told an agent at FBI headquarters that he hoped to raise interest in Zacharias Massawi, the alleged 20th hijacker, to make sure that Massawi, quote, did not take control of a plane and fly it into the World Trade Center, unquote. By the way, the title of 20th Hijacker is being, I think, fought over as rapidly as Fifth Beatle used to be, because I've heard at least three people identified as the putative 20th Hijacker. So let the games begin. And now, ladies and gentlemen, a regular feature of this broadcast, the apology of the week. Why would I make it singular? There are so many. Let's start with ex-aide to Yoko Ono. A former personal assistant to John Lennon and Yoko Ono agreed yesterday to surrender the copyright on hundreds of photographs he took of the couple and delivered an apology for stealing from them. The former assistant, Frederick Seaman, made the concessions as part of a settlement of a lawsuit brought by Ms. Ono. The settlement forbids Mr. Seaman to ever divulge any information about Mr. Lennon, Ms. Ono, or their son Sean, or to profit from that information. The resolution was a resounding victory for Yoko. She was heard singing in delight. Representative Tom Tancredo of Colorado apologized to his former allies in the National Term Limits Movement this week, but said he's sticking by his decision to walk away from his pledge to serve no more than three terms. "I'm sorry I let them down, because I did, and I would feel the same way if I were them." He announced he was not being constrained by his 1998 pledge to stay in Congress only three terms, because there's serious business going on now. It's security, you know, the national thing with the threats and the thing. So he's got to stay in because, you know, the thing. I don't think it's a money. One longtime friend and backer, former Senator Bill Armstrong, called it a hollow promise. His promise, Tancredo's promise, to give back any campaign contributions to donors who were upset about his violation of his term limits pledge. "To the extent you think harm is done," said Armstrong of his fellow Republican, "you don't repair it by giving the money back. The issue is, did he break his word? That's a hollow offer." Tancredo says the National Term Limits Movement has faded since its heyday. "I think my decision here, it's like taking a little bit of air out of an already deflated balloon," Tancredo says. He backed out of the term limits pledge because he was not sure he could abandon his growing role as an immigration reform leader in Congress. He says he's seen Tancredo for president bumper stickers in California and Oregon. So he's got very good eyesight. So he's sorry. Oh, I see. It's a, I got it here. "Our nation is confronted with a spiritual, physical, and philosophical threat that will require every ounce of our individual effort in its defense. If I'm elected to a third term, any decision to run for a fourth will not be made solely on the issue of term limits, but will be weighed against a number of things, including the continued existence of a fire in my belly for the challenge." So, what good is a promise when weighed against a fire in the belly? Isn't that what that new purple pill is for? U.S. Senator Tom Harkin's campaign manager apologized just before quitting, after acknowledging that his staff released the transcript of a closed-door campaign meeting of Harkin's opponent, Republican opponent. Republicans called for a criminal probe to find out who taped the private proceedings. After his apology wasn't enough, he resigned. On C-SPAN, the Washington Journal started out sedate, two members of Congress discussing the Iraqi situation, but then Bob Filner, a five-term Democrat from California, said something that made South Carolina Republican Joe Wilson go nuclear. Filner opposes unilateral U.S. military action. I'll read one of these words correctly. Don't worry about it. He suggested in the 1980s, when U.S. officials sided with Iraq in its war against Iran, Saddam Hussein had obtained biological and chemical weapons technology from the U.S. "We gave it to him," Filner asserted. "That is wrong. That's made up," Wilson fired back. "I can't believe you would say something like that." Filner calmly held his ground. advising Wilson to read newspaper reports and other documentation. Then the Republican erupted. This hatred of America by some people is just outrageous, and you need to get over that. Filner challenged. Hatred of America? Are you accusing me? Yes, Wilson shouted. For good measure, over the next minute, Wilson accused Filner of harboring hatred of America four more times, of being hateful three times, and of being viscerally anti-American once. Filner responded, this is not worth replying to. Wilson would not be interviewed by the Washington Post about it later, but did send a written statement in which he defended his position that Filner is all wet, but he added, if I said something in the heat of debate that was taken as critical of the congressman's patriotism or commitment to this country, I apologize. Somebody who's not apologizing yet, House Majority Leader Dick Armey, stands by comments he made in Florida last week characterizing liberal Jewish Americans as being of shallow, superficial intellect. He said none of the Jews in the room where he made the statements were as offended, and yesterday took the occasion to attack liberals in general, saying they're just not bright people. They don't think deeply. They don't comprehend. Armey first made his comments at a meeting with Jewish leaders while campaigning for Katherine Harris, Florida Secretary of State, who's running for Congress. He said, I always see two Jewish communities in America, one of deep intellect and one of shallow, superficial intellect. Conservatives, he said, have a deeper intellect and tend to have occupations of the brain in fields like engineering, science, and economics. What about Tom DeLay? Occupation? Exterminator. I go back to Dick Armey's quote, however. Liberals, on the other hand, tend to flock to occupations of the heart, which he defined as people with jobs in the arts. Meet some people in Hollywood, Dick, before you decide that these are occupations of the heart. It's not a real deep intellect if you can make that conclusion about show business. That's all I have to say. Other things learned in the congressional investigation of the intelligence situation this week: the FBI's electronic communication system is not designed to ensure that all addressees receive the communication that's addressed to them. Sounds like AOL. And finally, at the top of this week's news, ladies and gentlemen, in the Washington Post, I believe, no, sorry, it's the Philadelphia Inquirer. How would I do that? In the Philadelphia Inquirer, Peter Jennings feels more American than Canadian, but he's never applied for American citizenship since moving here in 1964. There are a lot of complicated reasons, he says, many of them private and having to do with my family. Jennings' mother was deeply concerned, he says, that I stay Canadian. She thought a lot of people went away from Canada and forgot their roots. Jennings' father was a prominent figure in the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, so he says, my mother wanted me to honor that in a pretty permanent way. I don't think that will always be the case. Let's hear those two sentences back to back one more time, ladies and gentlemen. There are no ellipses between those. My mother wanted me to honor that in a pretty permanent way. I don't think that will always be the case. He's been thinking for more than a decade about becoming an American citizen, if the country deems me worthy of it. Hands? It would be a very big step for me because I value the American ideal so much. I don't know whether I've made enough of a contribution to America. I wish to be a worthy citizen. Okay. He says he's having a love affair with America. He also says he carries in his back pocket a copy of the Constitution for inspiration. Maybe as this golden oldie from our found objects file would indicate, he needs it for more than just inspiration.
What are you doing?
Your end page.
My end page?
Our top stories.
Well, I think I'm going to start with the Flag Amendment, right?
Yeah.
Give me the type page. I'll just ad lib it, I think, is the answer. How long have I got?
Coming up to a minute left of this.
This is what I have so far. This is the old
piece. No, take it out.
Oh. And then
take it all out altogether, Kathy. Just take it out. I'm going to start with a flag.
So what would you like to prompt him to be at?
The House of Representatives has voted against a constitutional amendment. Against what, a constitution? Against...
Here, 20 seconds left.
Against what?
A constitutional amendment?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, there's another phrase in there.
That's okay. Your son, I'm Peter, we'll have a final report.
Yeah, take that, yeah. Hang on.
10 seconds, okay.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay, so you're gonna...
My question is, does the House come up to pass the amendment? Are they voting on the amendment? Doesn't the amendment have to go all through the states and everything before?
Once the House rejects it...
Yeah, but hold it. The question is, would the House have to pass the amendment? Is that what it's passed the amendment,
yes.
Right?
First, the House would have to vote to pass the amendment. Then it would go to the Senate. Then it would go to the states.
For ratification.
That's right. But since the House didn't, Foley says it's dead if you won't bring it up.
All right, thank you.
Thank God for a back pocket.
I should have seen.
This is Le Show, and a couple of items of Le Show business. Le Show business. First of all, last week, a correction, ladies and gentlemen. Last week, an emailer suggested that the book 9/11 Beauty Secrets was somehow exploiting the thing. Maybe a dozen people wrote me to say, hey, check it out, babe. It was published in 1999, and 911 was not referring to 9/11. It was referring to the number you call on the phone when you need real help with your beauty secrets. So sorry about that. An even more parochial item, if you're interested in seeing Teddy Bear's Picnic, my comedy film about the leisure activities of the rich and powerful in this country, fly to Pittsburgh. It's playing there this week at the Melwood screening room, so-called because it's a screening room in Melwood. On the other hand, if you don't want to see it and you're in Pittsburgh, fly someplace else. Now news of the media, ladies and gentlemen. This from a press release, so I haven't seen if there's a response to this yet. Dani Ash, the world's most downloaded woman and the only person in history to have been downloaded over a billion times, today revealed she's been threatened with legal action by National Public Radio Incorporated for tuning her company's telephone on hold radio to NPR's Los Angeles affiliate KCRW. Ms. Ash is a longtime fan and subscriber of KCRW, her local NPR station. She's also been interviewed on numerous NPR programs over the years and felt it was the natural choice for on-hold callers to the office of her world-famous website. The letter from NPR came as a complete shock, she said. Perhaps I've been naive in assuming nonprofit public radio is supposed to be about delivering high-quality programming to as many people as possible without bias, exclusion, or concern for financial gain. If you have to put someone on hold, why not try to make that a productive, rewarding experience for them? The writer of a recent Slate.com article made note of being impressed by an adult entertainment company that would choose to put NPR on hold for their customers. Danny's office received a threatening letter from NPR the following day. She was told by Neil Jackson, NPR's general counsel and secretary, that a failure to immediately remove NPR from her company's telephone system could result in, quote, litigation against your organization and against any persons or individuals knowingly causing, authorizing, or contributing to the continued infringement. She's complied with NPR's request. Wow. So I'm off her phone. She's removed NPR from her system, so I'm off her phone. Damn. Now, news of the digital wonderland. Some subscribers to one of the nation's largest cable systems are unable to make digital recordings of TV shows in what the company labeled an unforeseen technological glitch. Consumer advocates call it a chilling curb on home recording. An industry newsletter reported that Cablevision has invoked copy restrictions on all unscrambled digital TV programming delivered to its 3 million subscribers in New York. Ah, it's just New York. It renders a range of cable shows, from Different Strokes to Formula One Racing, unrecordable on certain types of devices. Kiss Your Betamax writes goodbye, ladies and gentlemen. The incident shows how easy it is for cable providers to block programming, according to consumer advocates. Even if what Cablevision did was inadvertent, they said it's an example of how copy blocking can be used to set limits on how individuals use the most ubiquitous of technologies, the television set. The trend is here. If Hollywood has its way, this is what the future looks like, says Joe Krause, co-founder of DigitalConsumer.org. Cablevision said it didn't deliberately suspend home recording. It blamed an unexpected clash between its access system, which makes sure subscribers see only the programs they've paid for, and the software inside Sony's television set-top boxes. The dots didn't connect. What do you want? It's the land of the dots not connecting. This software conflict somehow triggered a copy protection scheme known as 5C, which is designed to prevent mass duplication of television shows and movies. It labeled all digital programming off-limits to copying. The glitch prevents viewers from digitally taping any cable show using digital VHS machines. Well, that's not a lot of people. Yet. Meanwhile, in Washington, broadcasters and cable television system operators squared off in front of Congress, investigating that bill to turn off analog TV on New Year's Day 2007. Says New York Democratic Representative Elliot Engel, if on New Year's Day 2007 consumers turn on their TVs and see only snow, that could also be the end of many of our congressional careers. Industry representatives touted their progress, announcing the Super Bowl would be broadcast in HDTV. But listen to this weaseling. Here's the weasel thing again. Broadcasters asked the committee to require cable systems, which control 70% of the viewers, to carry both their analog and digital broadcasts during the switch. That's doubling the number of channels the cable would have to give to the broadcasters, and said that, listen closely, if broadcasters choose to subdivide their signals into multiple lower fidelity channels, cable systems should carry those as well. Now, why would they do that? Why would they want to have multiple lower fidelity? Because you could put commercials on each one. I see. Thank you. And finally, Italian public broadcaster Rai, casting doubt as to whether planned investments for the switch over to digital from analog are financially viable, Rai rang the alarm bell this week. Their management is frank about the crisis, which claims that Rai's financial structure is too fragile and not adequate to face up to the switch over to digital by 2006. It has yet to identify where it will get the money to undertake national DTV, national digital rollout. The financial commitment for technical equipment in Italy alone is $500 million. For PBS in this country, it's $1 billion. But, you know, Britain is spending $1 billion just to rebuild Wembley Stadium because they wanted to have something that was as big and as expensive and possibly as doomed as the Millennium Dome. Well, they got it. The new Wembley Stadium coming their way. Meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, the debate about Iraq actually became a debate this week. And, of course, in the grand American tradition, then became a debate about the debate. As former Vice President Al Gore became the first Democrat to publicly criticize President Bush's move towards a war with Iraq at a speech in San Francisco on Monday. Then President Bush, criticizing the Senate for failing to pass the Homeland Security Department bill, which was originally suggested by Joe Lieberman, accused the Senate of not caring about the nation's security, which made Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle go ballistic, went on the Senate floor and said it was outrageous. Later in the week, Senator Ted Kennedy also delivered a speech attacking Bush's policy on the war. Tom Daschle's approach up to this point has been to try to get the Senate resolution on Iraq through quickly, so that the debate would return to issues the Democrats would like to discuss for the fall election, like the economy and Social Security. Says one party strategist, quote, most Democrats just want this to go away. And Gore didn't just bring it up. He created a whole new debate. Meanwhile, former President Clinton was visiting Africa this week, and this coming week flies to Blackpool, England, where the Labour Party is having its annual conference to express his support for British Prime Minister Tony Blair, George Bush's number one ally. You see.
Clinton something, the Harlem years.
Man, I'll tell you something, James.
Yes, sir.
That Africa sure would be depressing if it wasn't for the music.
Mm.
So, how's your showbiz career going, Carville?
Well, I'm playing a cartoon of myself in a Disney movie.
You've been doing that on CNN for years.
That's true, but thanks to George W. Bush, I no longer have to share the gig with my wife.
Hey, how's Mary doing? Is she like working for Dick Cheney better than doing Alka-Seltzer commercials?
The money's worse, the hours are worse, the conditions are worse.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she does. True political junkie.
Hey, look, man, that's why I'm on my way from Zanzibar to Blackpool.
Man.
You know, I could be sitting at home writing that book they already paid me for, but I have to be out here where the game is played, you know? I mean, You know, people always used to talk about the enmity, the rivalry, the hostility between Jimmy Carter and me when I was president.
Oh, I know, man. Those stories were lamer than a one-legged nutria.
Oh, of course. But I'll tell you one thing, James.
Uh-huh.
I'm for damn sure going to be a better ex-president than that stone-faced preaching peanut farmer, too. And lending my support to Tony Blair in his hour of need is one way of doing that.
Well, they calling him Bush's poodle over there, ain't they? That's pretty rich, but what my folks tell me, he thinks Bush is dumber than a whiskey-soaked crawfish.
Yeah, but he's doing the job of a British prime minister in the modern era, holding the coat of the American president. Mm. And standing with him right now, well, it ain't the worst thing for my ex-president, Craig. Besides, you know who lives just about 10 minutes outside Blackpool? You remember that actress that was a finalist for the role of Xena?
Uh-huh. You know, we also talking to the Disney people about a reality show that would take a dozen political consultants and put them on an island for a month.
Huh? What's it called? Cannibal?
Hey, man, those of us who can't get $8 million deals to let a book write itself got to do some scrambling.
Well, I know it, but...
Sorry, Mr. President. Vice President Gore is on the line.
James, got to scramble myself. Stay crazy.
That's what they pay me for.
Hello, Al.
No, still me here.
Let me try it again. Hello, Al.
Bill, what'd you think of the speech that I gave in San Francisco about the war?
Good speech, Al. You know, I was in Djibouti at the time, but I read it on the internet. Some nice stuff in there.
Oh, but if you didn't see the footage, you didn't see my delivery.
Yeah.
See, we thought it was important that since I was staking a position to the left of the president,
mm-hmm,
and to the left of the rest of the Democrats,
uh-huh,
that I inoculate against any sense of wimpishness by coming across very strong. So,
well, I saw in a news photo you had a little piece of hair come loose on your forehead,
uh-huh,
so I figured you got a little worked up. But I just hope that in trying to come across strong, you didn't get back into that weird gospel shout of yours. Because let me tell you something, man, that could scare the nuts back on a capon.
No, I didn't do the shouting.
Yeah.
And to tell you the God's honest truth, we worked for a couple of hours, Corinna and I, to get the hair not to look so, you know, perfect.
Uh-huh.
I'm glad you caught that.
Yeah, well, good speech, man. You were really saying something.
You know, I thought it said, "Hey, America, here's Al Gore out in front on a major issue where all the other elected Democrats are afraid to speak their minds. Maybe we should take another look at this fella and next time vote him in so he stays in."
Well, you got pretty good coverage.
No.
You got Teddy Kennedy piling in after you.
I know. Could you believe that? Teddy Kennedy hasn't delivered a foreign policy speech since
three wives ago. Hey.
Even sorrier, Mr. President. Tom Daschle on the other secure line.
Thanks. Al, I got to take this call.
Can I hold?
Sure. I think we got Best of Classic Southern Rock as the whole music on this flight. Be right back. Mr. Leader.
Mr. President, how are you?
If I thought you cared, man, I'd answer you. Tom, I haven't heard from your South Dakota behind since Mark Rich started having cocktails with dinner again. What the...
Sir, I'm trying to carry on your work here in the Senate, dragging the Democratic Party kicking and screaming into the 21st century. You of all people know how hard that is.
Yeah, I do.
And of course, what people don't realize is that keeping a group of Democrats together is a lot harder than keeping a group of Republicans together.
Well, sure. The Republicans, they just need to get their corporate contributions. We have to get our share of those, and the union money, too.
Okay. Well...
See, the way I look at it, you're going into the midterms looking pretty good. Economy's in the toilet. So your problem would be...
Your friend Al Gore.
My friend.
We have the Iraq thing pretty much stashed away in a third floor conference room, and maybe we've given ourselves a week and a half of time to talk about our issues, the ones that can ensure that all three branches of government don't end up as a wholly owned subsidiary of Karl Rove, and then Al does his look at me, I'm a real Democrat act. Did you see that speech?
No, I was in Djibouti. I read it on the internet.
Well, count yourself among the fortunate. There were more waffles in it than in a Denny's on Sunday, but it just got a dozen of my guys so shook up, they immediately got their writers to go to work on Iraq speeches. Teddy already gave his, and he hasn't given a major public address since the Celtics were an all-white team. Just tell your friend Al that President Bush is going to do what he's going to do, whatever the Senate says, but what we can win is the election.
My friend, you know, Al would be sitting in the White House right now playing with his lockbox if he hadn't been too embarrassed to be seen in public with me. You know, I've talked to him exactly twice since I moved to New York, and once was just to ask me the name of an address of a rib place on Amsterdam Avenue. Mr. Leader, I'm flying to kind of the aid of Tony Blair, who's got a lot more problems with his left than you do with yours. I got more important fish to fry than Al Gore.
All right, sir. I just thought that the idea of preserving and restoring your legacy through maintaining a Democratic Senate, I thought that you might want to fry that, too.
Mr. Leader, a year ago I was all hung up about that legacy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I got a little more perspective now.
Well, that's good. I have to...
See, Magic Johnson's already in the Basketball Hall of Fame. Jimmy Carter's sitting down there in Plains, Georgia, taking phone calls about the plumbing going out in some Habitat for Humanity house he built. I'm still in the game. You take care, Mr. Leader.
I'll try.
Hello, Al? Al? Must have got caught off.
Man, you still good.
James, what's up?
Oh, your guy left me on the line.
Yeah.
I just love you and your work, man. They both go away remembering the same thing. Djibouti.
What can I say, man? Mark of a pro.
Youthful angst and middle-aged powerlessness. Together, they add up to Clinton something, the Harlem Years.
What made good Queen Bess such a great success? What made Wellington do what he did at Waterloo? What makes every Englishman a fighter through and through? It isn't roast beef or ale or home or mother. It's just a little thing they sing to one another. Stiff upper lip, stout fella, carry on old fluff. Chin up, keep muddling through. Stiff upper lip, stout fella, when the going's rough. Pip, pip to old man trouble and a toodly-oo-too. Carry on through thick and thin, if you feel you're in the right. Does the fighting spirit win? Quite. Stiff upper lip, stout fella, when you're in a stew. Sober or blotto, this is your motto, keep muddling through. Give him blow for blow. Make the blighter say, what's this? Allo, 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 allo. Stiff upper lip, stout fella, when you're in the stew. Sober or blotto, this is your motto,
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Wall Street Journal reports this week that the faith of big spending advertisers and the power of advertising is waning as the economy continues to falter. Companies are increasingly skeptical of the power of advertising to boost sales. So knock it off, guys. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, all up and down the East Coast via shortwave on WBCQ, the planet, at 7.415 megahertz. On your computer, whenever you want it, at two locations around the world, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com, but not on Danny Ash's on hold system. And it would be just like getting back on her on hold system if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, North Korea, another part of the Axis of Evil, along with Iraq and Iran, The United States is opening talks with North Korea this week. Or announced this week they're opening talks. We're not attacking them for some reason. Oh, here's the reason. According to the Bush administration, we don't think one size fits all. Clearly spoken by a non-pantyhose-wearing press aide. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as still and forever the home of the homeless.